You're listening to Just Women on Brooklyn's Radio. You can join in by emailing any comments or questions you may have to justwomen@brooklynsradio.co.uk or check us out on Facebook. Search for Just Women at Brooklyn's Radio. Just Women is just what you need.
And hello and welcome to Just Women, the weekly talk show on Brooklyn's Radio. It's Just Women for the next hour, talking to interesting, intriguing and inspiring women of all ages about subjects related to kids, work and life. Although today is the last one of our summer specials, so in fact we have one guest, a very special lady who we'll introduce in just a minute. My name is Celia Jones and my co-presenter today is Jackie Mitchell. Hi, Jackie.
Hello there, Celia.
And we are going to be talking for the whole hour today, and if you'd like to join in, we'd love to hear from you. Our email is studio@brooklynsradio.co.uk, so drop us an email and we'll try and include it into our conversation. So to start our programme and introduce our guest today, it's the wonderful Margaret Hicks, who is now Mother of the House as the longest standing County Councillor, Surrey County Councillor should I say, having represented Hersham since 1989. A big welcome to you, Margaret.
Well, thank you, and thank you for welcoming me here.
Yeah, and I said you could join us. Now, as I say, we're talking under the kids section initially. So what about your childhood? You were born in Cheshire, I understand.
Yes, I was born in Cheshire and I had the most wonderful mother who reserved an hour every evening to play with us and my brother games. We were put to bed before my father came home because we were still in the Victorian era of being brought up like children should be seen but not heard.
That's the one. Yeah.
But she dedicated that hour, and nothing would separate her from that time of being a good mother, mm-hmm. and making us feel really secure at home.
Mm-hmm. Did she work then? Was that why she...
No, she never worked. She was a housewife. My father did the work. He felt that was his responsibility. Mm-hmm. And so she was a wonderful mother.
So
never bought a cake. She made all her cakes, she made the jams, she made all the preserves, which was wonderful.
And so did you go to school locally?
I went to a private school locally. I was born in Sandy Way in Cheshire. I went to school, Perry's School in Hartford. I took the bus every morning as a small child. We were quite safe to do so. Came home by bus and had a very, very happy childhood living in Cheshire. And then I got very stubborn. My brother went to boarding school when he was 8. And I, being determined as I well said, if you can do it for my brother, you can do it for me. So you have to send me to boarding school.
So what appealed to you, do you think? Can you remember at that age? What was the sort of appeal of boarding school?
I think the appeal was that my brother had done it, so why not me? I think it's a sort of, had to be equality in the household.
Mm-hmm. I mean, did he come back from school saying how great it was? Did he enjoy his school?
Yes, he thoroughly enjoyed it. He went to the Dragon School in Oxford, which was a wonderful, wonderful school. And then after that, he went to rugby. Mm-hmm. I was fortunate to get into Cheltenham Ladies College. I fell in love with Cheltenham as a city or a town, as it was then, and I said, this is the place I have to be. The school was old. It was just so attractive. And I'm not sure about the uniform so much, which was sort of pea green, and we were called the pea greeners as we walked through the town to get to the school. But it was a very, very good school, mm-hmm. and it sort of set me up for life.
Mm. But 8 years old seems very young for boarding school.
That was for my brother. I went at 11.
Ah, okay.
So it was... Yes, it's probably a bit young for me, but...
And how did you get on? How were your first few weeks?
I was so excited, and they were very, very good. I had a very good house mother, and she sort of took a liking to me, which did help. Living in a dormitory wasn't quite so easy, and there was a lot of teasing, and a lot of tears. And once the novelty had gone, I think we all cried a bit, sort of being away from our parents. It was quite lonely. And in those days, you didn't see your parents except when you went home at the end of term.
Gosh, really?
Mm. Wow. So no visits and taking out to tea or anything?
No visits, no going out for tea.
Oh,
no.
Dear, that sounds quite a wrench then, really, for a child.
It was a wrench, but there again, I'd sort of, as my mother said, you laid your bed and there you lie. So, you know, I'd made the choice. They said they made it available for me. I passed my exam to get in there and I had to stay and I had to bite my upper lip and sort of say, well, that's it.
And how long were you there for?
I was there till I was 17.
And then what happened?
And then when I was 17, I left, and I worked for the school. Actually had a settlement in the East End of London, and I worked there with more unfortunate families. It really was the East End of London, and also I found where all our old school uniform went, because people just packed it off and it was sent there as clothing, but of course nobody wanted to wear that uniform.
No, I can imagine.
So, having experienced the boarding school, would you recommend it? I mean, did you send your children there? Did they ask to go?
Yes, my sons did. I had two boys, Anthony and Michael. I was living in Kuwait by that time, and the education in Kuwait was good, but it wasn't. It wouldn't have set them up for life. Mm-hmm. So when they were 8 as well, they took the lollipop special and flew back to England and again went to the Dragon School until they were 13. And at 13, they went on to rugby like their uncle had done.
Oh, right. So it's a family sort of yes. fate there, really. Yes. But how did you end up in Kuwait?
Well, I married somebody who was very different, and he was a Lebanese
gentleman. Wasn't it?
Yes, I first went to Lebanon, and I married him in 1965, and it was quite sort of... I liked different things, and my mother said, oh, I always did the different. I never did the conventional. And he took me out there. We arrived just before Christmas, and I must admit, I did feel homesick then, and I did cry. My first Christmas, I did miss the family Christmas that I'd been used to, because they were really special. But living in Lebanon was a fabulous country. The people were extremely kind to this very strange, shy young girl. And whilst I was there, I learnt French, so I speak French fluently, and I spoke Lebanese Arabic as well, so I could shop. And the country, it was a wonderful, wonderful country
to
live
in. So this was before the Troubles, was it?
It was just before the Troubles, but in fact it was quite interesting. My parents did come out to stay, and it was the time when the Israelis bombed the airport.
Oh, gosh.
And I always tell this story because I think it's quite funny. We used to get our English papers a day late, and they were sort of like on a sort of tissue paper, sort of very flimsy.
Yes, of airmail.
Now, my father could see, we were living in Beirut, he could see that there was no panic. Yes, the airport was closed, that they'd had been bombed. But the newspaper the next day when we got it, which was a day late, panic in Lebanon, panic in Beirut. And who do you think he believed?
The newspaper.
The Daily Telegraph. Which was quite amusing, you know, because the papers never lied.
No, quite.
No, of course they don't.
No, never.
And then what we did was my husband was asked if he'd like to work in Kuwait. So one early morning we got in the car. And with the children, my daughter wasn't born then, she was born in Kuwait. We drove to Damascus, we turned left, and then in the desert was a sort of like a cardboard sign, Baghdad, 800 kilometres. We turned right, and believe you me, that 800 kilometres was very, very long.
Was it across the desert then?
Right across the desert,
Oh my goodness.
And when no air conditioning in cars then either, was it?
No.
Goodness, must
How
be
else did you just survive?
Well, we did survive, because you do. I mean, we were young. You just get on with it, and it was an adventure. And I think there's a poem about the ribbon of a road that winds its way across deserted areas. And that was exactly what it was. You saw this ribbon of a road, and you thought, oh, is it ever going to end? Are we ever going to see civilization again?
So did you actually stay overnight then in Baghdad?
We stayed in Baghdad,
and then drove again.
And then we drove down alongside the Euphrates, down to Basra, and then on to Kuwait, which was had the border just there. And when we arrived in Kuwait, which was 1972, it was only a very new country, because Kuwait was only formed in 1965, that's right. So it became a country in its own right. So its capital is Kuwait, but the country... And it was very rich because of the oil.
And what sort of country was it when you got there?
Very deserted. Everywhere's deserted. Its townships were being built. on the desert. They liked the British, so the British companies were there to develop. They had the British forces out there, and all the food products, obviously, were there, sort of, so you could buy everything you needed, really. Although, today, I will never eat frozen meat, because all we used to get was frozen meat, which you had to defrost.
But was your husband working for one of the British companies then?
He was working for a Kuwaiti company then, who were the agents for British Airways and various other companies. So,
So he's in the travel industry?
Well, no, they were a commodity. Oh, okay. The Kuwaiti company was a huge conglomerate. Mm-hmm. Because how Kuwait separated itself is that there were the Kuwaitis who travelled, and the Kuwaitis who stayed at home, and they never mixed the families. So the travellers were the traders, and the people who stayed at home were the politicians.
Ah. And that's how countries are born.
What did your husband's job entail, exactly?
It was developing new opportunities for the Kuwaiti company to build its empire.
Ah, I see.
And it was a very good life there, though. You know, you made your life. It didn't come on a platter. Mm. You had to make it, but it was fabulous.
There can't have been many other English people there at that
there
time.
There were lots of English people.
Oh, really?
Because at that time, they were the people who were being brought in. And another, if you'd like another funny story, is when new British people were asked to come and work for this company, they thought they should interview the wife as well. I had a girlfriend staying with me, so the piece of paper said, Sammy and Margaret and friend. Sammy and Margaret and this other couple. And they mentioned wives. So this English lady who lived in Liverpool sat on the edge of her chair because she thought he'd married two wives. And it was only at the end of the luncheon that she suddenly realised, oh, I see, you're just friends. Although he was a Christian, he was a Greek Orthodox, so he wouldn't be allowed to marry two wives. But it was very funny, this tentative meal we had, and she didn't know how to do it politely or sort of not to make the wrong comment or something.
Which was the first wife, which was the second wife.
Hilarious, different.
A friend of mine who's been married for many, many years, and he always introduces his wife as, you know, have you met my first wife? It's his only wife, actually, but it makes it sound more interesting as the first wife.
How did you meet your husband, anyway?
Well, it was interesting. I have to thank my brother for that. My brother was at Imperial College, and my husband-to-be was doing a PhD there in mechanical engineering, and one day a party happened, and my brother introduced me, and that's how it happened, you know.
It's all one of those university parties.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
So going back to the children side of things, when you had the children, your first child in the Lebanon, what was your experience like there? That must have been quite difficult, wasn't it, if you didn't have family around to help or other women?
Yes, I mean, there was no... You went to the doctor when you had your appointments and sort of... He sort of said the process was going well, but he was French-speaking, which didn't have any English at that time. So it was quite interesting, and I was just emerging as a French speaker. When I did ring him and say, I've had my first contraction, he said, oh, go and have a bath and everything. Don't worry yourself. And I said, well, they are 5 minutes apart. Don't you think I ought to be coming in? And he said, well, I suppose you ought to and everything. And luckily, 2 hours later, Anthony was born.
God.
Wow.
But he was that in the home there?
It was at a private clinic. But it was quite a curiosity because he was such a blonde little thing, you know. Mm. And they quite liked the little blonde babies because that was sort of rather nice and sort of different. So everybody came to see the blonde baby.
So by the time you had your second one, then you were quite experienced and knew what to expect. And
well, the trouble is we always said, you know, well, we did it once and within a year I had a second one. And another little blonde equal, and he's Michael, his name is. So that was lovely.
He caused an equal sensation, being blonde.
Yeah,
suppose,
exactly,
again.
Yes. Mm. But it's quite interesting is that the Arab way is that my husband could have been called Abu, father, Anthony, which is the first son. So Abu Anthony is what was traditionally used to happen. Their fathers used to take on the name of their firstborn, which had to be a boy, of course, because in those days boys were important. It's, never mind if you have a girl, but, you know, sort of commiserations, but no.
Next time, boy.
But there was no midwives, there was nothing else like that after that, and it was a little bit trial and error, sort of, and friends, luckily friends who'd had babies helped me sort of learn to be a mother.
Your mother didn't sort of rush out on a plane or anything? No.
In fact, she thought she'd never see me again when I flew away in 1965. She thought, you know, because in those days you didn't travel.
Well, no, that's true.
And to get to Lebanon, you had to go two-stage. It wasn't a direct flight from London. But we did come home, and I remember sort of saying, well, here you are. And then they took responsibility for the boys when they were at boarding school for half term. So they really saw the boys grow up, which is rather nice.
Oh, absolutely, yes. And what was life like in the Middle East as a woman then? Because it's difficult even now, so I can't imagine what it was like.
Not in the countries I've been in.
Oh, really?
I mean, the Lebanon is a very free country and everything, and Kuwait, it was a free country. I could drive my car. I mean, you didn't disrespect and sort of wear sort of strapless dresses when you went into the souk. And if you wanted to wear a bikini, you wore it in the big hotels, swimming pools. You didn't flaunt your body. You regarded their respect of women. It was a perfectly easy life. Perfectly easy life.
Sounds rather good, doesn't it? Well, now, Margaret, we do ask all our guests to come up with a couple of top tips for any particular sort of area that we're talking about. Would you have a couple of top tips maybe for mums having kids abroad or worried about maybe their husbands are going to be moved abroad and that?
Well, I think when you have a child abroad, or if you have a child anywhere, really, it's sort of remember that you give yourself time to bond with your little one, because it's in a tummy and then it's born and it's a little stranger to begin with, and it's sort of trying to sort of keep the child uppermost, and that you don't let visitors and everything disturb a routine. You do, as your body has got to recoup after having a baby. And so do it. I mean, there's having a child abroad, but I must admit the one good thing that happened was that Margaret Thatcher allowed me to give the children British passports. So beware also that if you are two generations born abroad, that you might have to take that nationality unless you come home and have your babies, because that is the law in this country. So my children, if they had their children abroad, they wouldn't be able to pass on the British passport.
Gosh.
Which is quite interesting. Yes, that's two generations. So born abroad, children born abroad, you take the nationality of the country where you're born.
But that sounds rather strange, doesn't it? Especially, I mean, if you were born abroad just because your parents happened to live there for that particular moment. I mean, I've heard of people who've just been abroad and, you know, working for 2 years, had the child, and then came back and worked in the UK for the rest of their lives, lived in the UK for the rest of their lives, and then...
But if that child was born abroad and then their children were born abroad...
Yeah.
Yes. I think they'd have two passports, you know.
Yes.
Some countries allow dual nationality.
Yeah, I think Australia does.
Yes. Mm. And yes, and all countries have got wonderful health care now, so enjoy living abroad. I encourage everybody, but remember, come home. It's nothing like being home.
And any tips for people that are actually moving overseas for the first time, how to settle into a country? Because it sounds as though you did a very good job doing that.
I think what I did is, as I listened to the languages, and if you can learn the colloquial greetings, I know if you were in the Arab world and you know the colloquial greetings, they think, well, you've made an effort. And they just blossom. They just think, oh, well, you've not just come and you're going to make a little England here. You're actually trying to live within the culture of where you're living. Obey the culture, obey the laws, and you can have a very good life abroad. Mm. There's some wonderful people you meet. Yes. We used to have parties for about 50 people sometimes, and we had 20 nationalities. when living in Kuwait, and it was so rich. It was just wonderful. So enjoy abroad, enjoy the experiences, but as I say, don't forget home is home.
Yes, quite. And no place like home. As she clicked her some ruby slippers. Well, we're going to have to take a short break now, but we'll be right back talking to Margaret Hicks about her work with the Surrey County Council. So stay with us.
This is Just Women, every Tuesday at 1 o'clock on Brooklands Radio.
Hello there and welcome back to Just Women with me, Jackie Mitchell and Celia Jones. And we're joined today with Margaret Hicks, who is known as Mother of the House, as she's the longest standing county councillor, having represented Hersham since 1989. Now, I'd like to now come on to the work section, Margaret. So how did you become a councillor then?
Well, when I moved to Hersham in 1984, I quickly got involved with life. I helped my daughter with her guiding. And in fact, I've been treasurer to Hersham Guides since then. So it's quite a long session. And then I ran the WRVS for Walton, Weybridge and Hersham.
And that is what exactly?
Women's Royal Voluntary Organisation. Yes. But we're not allowed to advertise it because they don't like it to be linked with politics. But I did run it and I got to know the area extremely well, and I think people got to know me without my realising it. I've always been a Conservative. When I lived in London, I was a young Conservative. So when I arrived here, I looked to join the Conservative Party, the Hersham branch, and I then sort of was willing to go around canvassing and asking people what they would like to do. So a couple of years I did that. And then one day I said, well, what is it next year? And they said, well, it's the county council. I said, well, who's the candidate? And they grinned and said, would you like to be? And I said, oh, all right, I've got nothing to lose. So, you know, let's give it a go. And that's how it all started.
How amazing. So by accident, really?
It was really by accident, yes. By the then county councillor was standing down. And there was a vacancy for a new person.
And how did you feel? Did you feel nervous when you won?
Well, I was elated and I was quite touched that people would vote for me, which was nice. But actually, they were voting for the Conservative Party. One has to understand I was represented the Conservative Party and I was sort of known by some and not known by others, but they voted for the party. And then they had the sort of weeks of induction and I thought, what have I let myself in for? Because huge amounts of information, huge amounts of figures were thrown at you and you sort of look dazed and you think, oh my goodness, is this me? Because all I am is a housewife. I love people, but I am a housewife.
And when you took on this role, were your children still at home?
My children were still at home, yes. They were just finishing their education. So I had, for the first time in my life, really, time to maybe do something for myself, rather as well as being a sort of mum and a wife. It was important that I sort of developed as well.
Yes.
And it was just opens doors, which I think is absolutely marvellous. It's yes. Most privileged.
So you'd worked overseas in Lebanon and Kuwait. So how did you, what brought you back?
My husband brought me back because he'd finished his work there and he sort of said, and we looked to see if we wanted to live back in Lebanon. But there was then, as you know, the troubles were there. And if you went on a bridge, there was like a sign with a tank on it, so there were tank crossings. And I thought, if I went there and I put Fiona on a bus to go to school, would she come home safely? I did start worrying about her safety because we didn't live by a school, unfortunately. She would have to have gone by bus. And so I sort of said to my husband, are you happy for us to go back to England? And he said yes. And that's how we came back. So.
And was there a big adjustment to make?
It was quite a big adjustment because, in a way, people have their lives in England and they're sort of... They weren't terribly interested about people living abroad and their experiences. They'd say, oh, yes, okay, you know, that's nice and nice to know. But and what about this and what about, you know, but it wasn't sort of, so you suddenly realise you had sort of 18 years, which I did abroad, which was sort of a little pocket for me. But when you meet somebody who's lived abroad, you can talk about it, but you don't talk about people who haven't lived abroad because their life obviously is in the communities where they live and that's where their interests are. So, and at that stage, we were all looking at schooling for our children. Children and opportunities to do things, and of course, I like to be active. So,
And what brought you, because you didn't move originally to Hersham, did you? You were no. living elsewhere and then came to Hersham. Well, what made the jump to Hersham?
Well, when my mother and father lived in Milford-on-Sea, and of course for five of us to descend on them who were getting older was too much. So we bought a house in Milford-on-Sea, which friends used when we weren't using it. So it was always, you know, something to do. And my father enjoyed looking after it too, and he had the telly there and everything, so he could escape home a little bit. Not that he had to escape home, but, you know, it was nice to have a purpose. Mm-hmm. And my daughter went to school in that area, and then my husband then needed to get to abroad a lot, so we needed to become closer to an airport. So we looked in a magazine and we saw sort of this area, and we sort of said, well, that's nice, found a house. And we moved to Hersham, and it's the best thing that ever, ever happened to me. It's the most fabulous place to live. It's your immediate... If you give to Hersham 1 ounce, they give you back a ton. Mm-hmm. You're mm-hmm. accepted straight away.
Are you still in the same house?
No, I've moved house since I've downsized, because as the children fly the nest.
Yeah. But yeah. I think you were saying that also it's the people of Hersham that you know, you've got four generations of people who've lived there. And I think we've found that with some of the people we've interviewed on this programme, is that there are a lot of people who've lived for a long time in this area, and it's fascinating to hear all the changes.
Well, a lot of, when I first arrived, it sort of seemed to have died down a bit, but which is a bit of a pun, isn't it? But the people of the fourth generation, the older generation, had been in service in the big houses in Hersham, which are now names of streets, because the houses have been pulled down, obviously, and they've got estates now and everything. But it was, but it's lovely to see these families that haven't moved and how supportive they are, because that's what really family life is about, is family being together. Mm-hmm. Not spread around the world as they are.
That's true. So within the council, what sort of roles did you get initially, and how has it changed over the years that you've worked there?
Well, with no disrespect, when I first joined, there was a gypsy committee. And I said, one committee don't put me on is the gypsy committee. So which do you put on? You put on the gypsy committee, which actually was fantastic in the end, because it let me understand. We have a lot of people who are of gypsy origin living in the area. We have certainly around Hersham area. And it gave me an understanding of where their roots came from, where their language came from, their customs. And I thoroughly enjoyed myself. But then the laws changed and the responsibilities for gypsy communities really has been cascaded down to the boroughs. Mm-hmm. So, but it was enlightening, really, and I have a sympathy for these people who hold on to their traditions, and quite rightly so, because I believe tradition is important.
Mm. So the county council is I mean, maybe some listeners would be interested to find out, I mean, how does the county council work with the local borough councils? Because I think these days a lot of people are very familiar with their borough council. That's where they pay the council tax. That's where they, you know, have an instant connection because it's very nearby. Where does Surrey County Council fit into the day-to-day borough council?
Well, you're absolutely right. And I'd like to go back into history a little bit. In the early 1990s, an organisation called the Boundary Commission wondered whether we should get rid of county councils, get rid of borough councils, and split and have unitary authorities. And at that moment, Surrey could have been maybe split into two or three. And so the borough councillors became very militant about them organising one of those sections to the detriment of relationships with Surrey County Council, and almost caused a hatred and a bitterness. And that bitterness is there a little bit now. When I first became chairman of the Elmbridge Local Committee, which was 6 years ago, I realised that relationships weren't good, because the committee is made up of 9 county councillors and then equivalent 9 borough councillors. Working together was not as easy as it could be, because there was this mistrust. Surrey could have been seen as the big brother. And the borough seemed sort of, they just didn't seem to harmony. And I remember going into a meeting which was for parking, and there were 9 men and myself. And I walked in and I said, right, because I was chairman, so chairman has prerogatives. I said, right, what are we going to do to action out of this? this isn't a meeting for action, they said. And not only that, the borough officers, the county officers, the borough councillors, the county councillors just didn't get on with each other. By the end, the borough councillors, borough officers were saying, when can we have the next meeting? Because what I did is I found something we could be seen to be doing together which would enhance the life of Elmbridge. And they enjoyed it so much that they realised that actually action can come out of meetings if I'm chairing, because, you know, I work very hard with Rob Moran, who is the chief executive of Elmbridge. We meet on a regular basis for me to explain what we're doing, how we can enhance, because I look at, for myself, looking at Elmbridge, not Elmbridge Borough Council, but Elmbridge as an area that we need to enhance and work together, because people don't understand county council, borough council. Mm. They just understand the word councillor.
Yes.
And in fact, you've just got to be able to sort of say, as councillors, we all work for the benefit of our people. That's the nature of councillors. And you shouldn't just say, well, I'm a county council, I don't do that, or I'm a borough council, I don't do that. No, actually, you have to enable things to happen.
Mm. I thought, to be honest, I thought it was going to be more clear cut that the borough councillors had certain roles to do with the local borough, that they would, I don't know, for instance, potholes in the roads or something. I think, in fact, that's Kasari, but so think of something else. Can't think of something else. But anyway, so there's sort of issues that are very local that they control, and then Surrey County Council has a much, because you have the wider brief of the whole of Surrey.
Yes.
You could be doing Elmbridge and Runnymede at the same time or something, and therefore that's where the Surrey County Council comes in, because you've got two councils that might be doing something different otherwise.
Well, that's very true. I mean, the borough has very distinct areas that they operate in. Surrey County Council have very distinct areas they operate in. In fact, they've got a 1.6 billion, Surrey County Council, 1.6 billion budget. 700 million of that goes to, passported straight out to education for the schools, mm-hmm. paid teacher salaries. About 488 million goes on salaries. So there's not an awful lot of money to be spent. But nothing should be done in isolation. I hate ghettos, and what I find is that if you allow a ghetto to create, you're not actually starting to work. And what you've got to look is the working for the borough, so the people of the borough, you know, which might have a facility that is financed through Surrey County Council, might have a facility like housing through the borough. Mm-hmm. But as far as people are concerned, it should be cohesive.
Hmm.
Whilst the borough councils make their decisions, county councillors make their decisions through the local committee. We actually are sharing decision making, and I'm a great believer that to be effective, 18 of us can be very, very effective.
Because the other thought I had was, sorry, I was just thinking of, I'm in Spelthorne, and I think it's Spelthorne and Runnymede have got together over waste management, I think it is, and they've signed up some contractor where, because they're doing the two boroughs, they're getting a better deal. And it struck me then, well, I mean, that's absolutely great and good for them, and we like the idea of saving, but then why didn't that come under a Surrey thing? Because then if they'd done it with Elmbridge and Woking and whatever boroughs they are in Surrey, they could have got an even better deal, couldn't they?
Well, the interesting thing is there is probably an understanding is that the boroughs collect and the county disposes of waste. And this is where this arrangement has happened. Runnymede and Spelthorne have got together for the collection. We, as Surrey County Council, dispose.
Ah.
And that's where these arrangements... But more and more across the county, there is working together. So there's a sort of general feeling that we all the 12 councillors, so the 11 borough councillors and one county council, can work together, say, for procurement, for IT, for all these, so that we all have the same systems. And more of that is happening. So those sort of barriers that were there are breaking down.
Mm-hmm.
And the same with businesses. I mean, Surrey County Council is very into supporting businesses, so small businesses and big businesses, to actually enhance the opportunities for employment and for us to prosper as a county.
Mm-hmm. And which area are you covering at the moment then in your personal, as a councillor, what area?
Well, at the moment, this time around, I'm not great one to saying you're chairman and things like that, but I'm actually with the adult social care.
Mm-hmm.
I am with planning. I've just this morning been on the adoption panel, which is a very privileged position, and I do a foster panel as well. So those are my sort of main committees, as well as the I chair the Elmbridge Local Committee as well, which is a lot of work.
Yes, it must be. And what's the most challenging out of those?
Well, the moment is that we've got 18,000 drains in Surrey, in Elmbridge, and you will notice when we have heavy rain, there's a lot of flooding.
Indeed.
And the trouble has been is that it's there are only three companies in the country that actually do drain, deal with drainage. And we seem to have had misfortunes of not actually getting the drains unblocked well and things like that. So a new contract has just been signed with Conway's through Magurney, and they are guaranteeing us that they will address all the drains in the county. Starting, we in Elmbridge will be starting mid-October until the end of the year, which is the fiscal year, the end of March. And by that time, they will have recorded all of the near on 18,000 drains, and they will have cleared them all and gone back to those that are thoroughly booked. And so I've just sent an email to my county councillors on the committee saying that if you're doing a publication, would you tell people to be mindful not to park over a drain, because it's very difficult to clean it if, if a car is parked over it. And little tips like that sort of see if we can do it, because that is one of the big frustrations. And you see the flooding, you know, as soon as we get these downpours, you know, and it's got to be cleared, who knows. Because
so that's obviously a big project. Yes. It's going to take a long time, I would imagine.
Yes, it will do. But with the new contractors, so I had a meeting with them and I challenged them. And I said, you know, I expect now this to happen. You made your promises. That's what I went for. I wanted the promises made so that actually we can achieve.
Yes, indeed.
So can you then influence that in Spelthorne and the other boroughs as well?
I could do, but I can...
become the drain lady.
The drain lady, absolutely. Well, what we do is all the chairman of the local committees do have a meeting once a month, and I shall be bringing it to them for them to sort of do the same as I've done, you know, that if you want, have those conversations and get the work done.
Well, I'm afraid it's time for tips again, Margaret. The time's just flying today. So tips regarding work, I mean, or, you know, sort of being on the council, is that something you would recommend other women to try?
I would.
And do they have to be affiliated to a political party?
No, you don't have to be affiliated to a political party. And when you have elections, there are always three or four or five candidates. You can come as an independent, and the major political parties, or even UKIP. I shouldn't say even UKIP. UKIP or Green. You can represent your people, whatever party you wish to be, under which flag you wish to be under. It is the most privileged and wonderful job to do. There is no book that tells you how to do it. But my attitude is that if somebody contacts me with luckily with now emails that we have, I am probably within their house within 24 hours discussing their problems, because a face-to-face is so much more valuable than the written word. And people feel that they've been listened to. And we usually find solutions, because having been there as long as I have, my address book is very, very effective.
I was going to say, and you've seen it all.
And if somebody wanted to become a councillor, how do they go about it?
Well, Surrey County Council elections, or County Council elections, are always, the whole country are every 4 years, so we've just had. If you want to become a borough councillor, some boroughs, like Elmbridge, they do it every 3 years. So 1 year Surrey County Council, and then there's the ward councils for the next 3 years. If you wish to become, it's easier probably to affiliate yourself with a political party or an independent, but it does help to be known a bit. And also to plan what you are going to offer the people if you become the councillor, and keep to your promises.
Yes, very wise words. I hope some politicians are listening as well. Now, we have to take another short break, I'm afraid, but we've still got lots to talk about with Margaret, if we can only have a little more time, but we'll be right back after these messages.
This is Just Women, every Tuesday at 1 o'clock on Brooklands Radio.
And welcome back to Just Women with me, Celia Jones, and Jackie Mitchell. And we're talking to Margaret Hicks, Surrey County Councillor, and as we just heard, all the interesting things she does within the council. But we're just asking, really, what about the spare time? Now, you do a lot of charity work. Do you want to tell us a bit about the charity work?
Well, I'm fortunate to be a member, a trustee of a few charities. The John Bean charity, which is a very interesting one, which gives sort of white fridges and freezers and things like that, carpets, curtains, will pay for school uniforms, and that's for the people who really are struggling in living in Surrey. I'm a member of the charity of Robert Phillips, which is fabulous. He used to be an alderman, and he left £1 million, which has grown in quantity, and there are six trustees, three borough councillors, three county councillors. That's for the old parish of Walton. And we give out money for museums, for school orchestras or music, for concerts. He loved bands, so if anybody wanted to have a band, we could help to pay for the event. And it's absolutely lovely, and we love meeting there because we get requests and we're able to give out. If a child has got grade 6 music, we'll buy them a new instrument. But you have to live in the old parish. We have to. The charity commissioners are very strict with us on that.
Well, where is the old parish? How does that extend
it's
from
Walton, Hersham, and Oatlands?
Oh,
Oatley.
Really?
Yes. Oh, I see. It's quite a big area then.
Yes,
I was thinking it was a small
area,
parish of just the centre of Walton or something.
And then I'm involved with the Volunteer Bureau, a trustee there, which I can't thank volunteers enough for all they do. Surrey wouldn't survive without its volunteers. And if anybody has ideas of they want to volunteer, just go along there or to Walton Library, where they've got a desk, and just offer your time. It doesn't have to be a lot of time, but just offer it, because you get such joy out of giving and doing. I'm very interested in the food bank at the moment, which is operating out of our church, St Peter's, and out of St John's. And it's quite shocking that in these days that there are people who are living on the poverty line and are in crisis and have no food. But if you go, we had a day at Waitrose where we collected, and seeing people having the opportunity to give was fantastic. Even if it was just a can of soup, it was just lovely. And they sort of were so happy to be able to give. So we've been able to store a lot of food. It's all non-perishable. But it's really good.
Excellent. And there's the Children's Trust at Tadworth on your list. What does that do?
Children's Trust at Tadworth are for the children who are born with the most profound difficulties. They probably, by the end leaving school, have reached about 9 months of learning of age. Usually they are intravenously fed and everything else like that. But everybody has a right to an education. And when you see that smile come on those children's faces, you know you've won. It's absolutely brilliant. It's also a centre where a lot of children who have brain damage from car accidents go and have rehabilitation. That was a wonderful time in my life to be there, but you could only be a trustee for 9 years, and quite rightly, they move people on. But that was a fantastic, a well worth charity if you ever want to give.
And what about the Burr Hill Children's Centre?
Burr Hill Children's Centre, there are children's centres are all over the county, which are family centres where young families can go along, learn to be parents, learn to read to their children, just teaching people to be families. Also, it's giving mothers an opportunity, or fathers, an opportunity to go back to work, learn to go back if they've taken time off to have their children. And it's a wonderful support area. They also have a time for pet fathers. They have fathers' mornings. They have everything just for the family, to make the family cohesive. And of course, the children prosper from that.
Do you think, I mean, that's probably a lot to do with, do you think, the fact that families are so moving around so much that, you know, whereas you used to have a grandparent nearby to offer advice or talk to, that's not the case, and therefore these centres are just brilliant to be able to talk about what their problems are as a family?
Yes, I think so, and I think you will find that there are three generations who've never had work. Mm-hmm. And it's not because they haven't wanted to have work. It's just circumstances are sort of, and sort of, it's a family lull that happens. And it gives a very different dimension if your parents are not going out, or your father isn't going out to work. And it's encouraging people to do that. But it's sort of trying to stop the rot in a way, because self-esteem, I can't believe anybody who doesn't go to work, hasn't got a job, has the self-esteem that they deserve.
Hmm. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah,
that's very true. So, in between all these activities, I gather you also do Meals on Wheels. Is that something you still do?
I did Wheels on Wheels when I was WRVS. I used to do it out of Weybridge, and I did it alone, because in those days you can't now. You must do it in twos, and that way I could spend a little time on my round. This person, I could spend a little bit more time 1 week, because there is a lot of loneliness.
Yes.
And it's just a lifeline. And possibly I was the only person they'd spoken to that day. And you often found people forget to turn the gas off, or, you know, little things, but the little things that made a difference. A smile on the day.
Yes. And also, you're very musical, aren't you? You're a member of three choirs.
I'm a member of three choirs, yes, that's my relaxation. I think you need time out. Yes. So to sing.
Which ones are they?
Well, it was the police choir, Surrey Police Choir, but we now call Sounds Arresting is one of them. And that's, which is
good.
A pun, because we didn't seem to represent the police as much, but I used to be on the police authority, so I was able to sort of link it that way. And that's fun, because we sing the show music, and we took part in the Godalming Music Festival this year and won the cup of one of our sections. So it was good.
Yes.
I love singing. I love to encourage people to sing. So at the moment I'm helping to note bash, as I call it, an ad hoc group of singers that will be singing at St. Nicholas Church in October. And we're doing Haydn's Te Deum. And that's quite a difficult piece. It is actually a singer's piece. It's a sort of quite difficult. And that's coming along now. And I've got one more rehearsal, and then I hand it over to the conductor, who's going to take over and do it. Because I don't know how he wishes to hit sung, but I'm doing as best I can. And it's quite nice, because when I joined that choir, people were not so chatty, but now I can't stop them chatting at break time, because they now know each other, they enjoy each other's company, and of course they sing so much better when you do that. And of course I'm a member of St. Peter's Church, and I sing there as well.
My goodness, but you also conduct, don't you, as well?
I was encouraged at County Hall, and I do the staff choir there. We are going to develop it more, because there is a theory now that singing actually is very therapeutic, and they want to do sort of have an opportunity for people to sing every week a little something. We did put on a summer concert, which was a lot of work. It tied me down every Friday for 3 months, but it was successful. But at the moment we'll do the carols. I persuade the chairman to put on a refreshments. We sing carols, and we get a good turnout of people. We get a good turnout of singers, and they just love it. But we also get a good turnout of people to come and hear us, and I get them singing as well. So
it's
very, very good. And I find two readings, one for the chairman and one for the chief executive, which are around Christmas, but not Bible reading, as they are sort of, they've got a moral.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and where did you learn to sing yourself? Are you a soprano?
I am a soprano. I learned to sing when I was at boarding school. Going back, this is a big circle, isn't it? I learned to sing there. I love singing. You had to actually be able to sing to be able to join that choir, because you had to be able to pitch, and you were, you know, at, and it's. I've taken it. I sang in Lebanon. I've sang all over the place.
And then how did you learn to conduct?
It came as a sort of like, I became a county councillor. Suddenly somebody said, right, you'll take the choir today.
Oh, I see. Right.
And I sing with the U3A as well, and I've been helping out there, because our conductor had a well-earned, I think, 5 weeks in America to see his family. So another gentleman and I sort of took it. But people quite like me doing it, because I'm encouraging. I make people laugh, you know. And I always end with them choosing what they want to sing, something that they enjoy singing, and it just lifts the soul. role.
Fantastic. I mean, there's a bit of a Gareth Malone as well doing it in the workplace, isn't it? I mean, he's famed much for all workplaces having choirs and singing at lunchtime and things like that. Sort of a very good morale booster, I suppose, as well, isn't it? Walking you also do with a dog, is that right?
I walk with my crazy cocker spaniel. He was alpha dog, and boy, wasn't he a difficult puppy. He was really difficult, but he's absolutely wonderful. He's 10 years old now. He's called George. My second husband, allowed me to have a dog as long as it had an English name. So I thought, George, it has to be. And George it was.
Very popular these days, isn't it? Very royal
but
name.
But I tell you one thing, it's very good. It makes me go out walking. It makes me. And you meet lovely dog walkers. But actually, I could become a couch potato if I wasn't careful. You know, but having a dog, you actually have got to discipline. So if I have a meeting at 8, I'm out at 6, you know, in the morning, because he needs his walk.
Yes. And did you do dog training with him? Did you do the whole
sort of... We tried, but he wasn't a very... He was alpha dog. He was a very difficult dog. And in fact, the owner, we met later, and he said, "You haven't still got him, have you?" And he said, "Yes, we persevered with him," because he was very difficult. But he's actually...
He's quite a handful. But
he's very good now.
Mm-hmm. He does settle down in the evening and not to tear the house.
And when you come home, 100% love. It's lovely. Can't go wrong in their eyes. Mm. Get a dog.
Yes. They're always pleased to see you, aren't they?
No, always pleased to see
you. And you also do a lot of reading. What sort of books do you like reading?
Yes, that's a holiday. I've got my Kindle, if I'm allowed to use the word Kindle, and it's just wonderful. You can absorb yourself into their novels I read. It's not high pressure stuff, because with all the reading I have to do for the county council, you learn to skim read. And then, so when I try to read a story, I have to go back on the pages and learn to read properly again, rather than skimming over words and getting the gist.
And who are your favourite authors?
Well, my favourite book is Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier.
Yes.
I mean, I just love her books. I don't think she's a wonderful writer, and I can absorb myself. I can read that time and time again.
Yes, I know what you mean.
It's wonderful, isn't it? Oh dear. So, any hints and tips on life, the universe?
I think is be a good listener. Look after your friends. Your family are important, but your friends are. And your friends are almost like your pet. They're forgiving because they are your friends. But enjoy life. Smile. And never say no. Doors are always open. If you don't say no, maybe, perhaps, but never say no. Because if somebody asks you to do something, always say yes, because you'll really enjoy doing it.
Yes. The trouble is I then run out of time because I've said yes too many times. I think I've really got to learn to say no. But anyway, there we go. I'll just do a maybe. I'll do a few more maybes, maybe. That's the answer. Well, Margaret, thank you so much for joining us today. That's been absolutely wonderful. We've gone round the world and back again. We've learned a lot about the council as well. I don't think we could have had a nicer guest for our Tuesday, for our final summer specials. So thank you very much indeed for joining us today.
Well, thank you very much, and good luck to Brooklands Radio.
Thank you. So thank you very much for listening today, and join us again next week for Just Women. That's 1 o'clock on Tuesday. So it's goodbye from me, Celia Jones.
And goodbye from me, Jackie Mitchell.
You're listening to Just Women on Brooklands Radio. You can join in by emailing any comments or questions you may have to justwomen@brooklandsradio.co.uk, or check us out on Facebook. Search for Just Women at Brooklands Radio. Just Women is just what you need.